Hi, I'm Marco Werman. Over the past several months, we have all experienced how an event in a corner of China has overwhelmed and reshaped our lives. As I speak, COVID-19 continues to spread through virtually every country on Earth. We began reporting on the coronavirus in January, and our content is freely available to everyone. None of our coverage has ever been behind a paywall. Global reporting is expensive to create, which is why we are asking for your support during this brief appeal. We're grateful when you listen to public radio, and especially grateful for supporting the journalism of the world in this moment. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute, or follow the link right here in the episode notes. That's theworld.org/give. Be safe, be healthy, and thank you. South Korea is using a smartphone app to try to prevent a second wave of COVID-19.
The system is designed to be implemented by people of good faith, but the app does also track you.
I'm Marco Werman. Here in the U.S., there's a push to tap into an unused reservoir of doctors with overseas degrees.
They have the skills, they have the knowledge, they have the ability, but we're just sitting there idly doing nothing.
Also, this British family does a lockdown version of Les Miserables, and it is a hit. Those stories and the latest news today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us this Friday. We are all watching the numbers. The number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 now tops 1 million. Tens of thousands of people have died from the disease. The number of people unemployed rises every week as we stay at home to slow the pandemic. The big economic number here is $2 trillion. That is the dollar amount of the stimulus package approved by Congress last week. We wanted to know how the U.S. plan compares with those of other countries. Economist Jason Furman led President Obama's team of economic advisors in the White House, and he says European countries got a head start on economic stimulus. Take Denmark, for example.
The employers, the labor unions, and the government in Denmark sat down and said, don't fire people. The government will pay 75% of your wages. You have to pay 25%, and the workers have to effectively work for free for 5 days. So all three groups are, you know, contributing something to make this work. In France, they have a paid leave system paid by the state. And if you operate a small business and your worker can't work right now, you're going to continue to pay them and you'll get reimbursed by the government. For the person who can't work, it's seamless. They're getting paid the same. For the employer, they're getting reimbursed. So a lot of these are expanding on institutions and systems that European countries already had.
You know, the example of France, where I believe a friend of yours got instructions from the government to just keep paying his nanny.
Yeah. So a friend of mine in France has a nanny, and she can't work now because of this. And she got a letter from the government saying if she can't work, continue to pay her and, you know, we'll reimburse you. That is something that would have happened in normal circumstances if, say, the nanny, you know, got pregnant and had a child and got parental leave. And that same system is just taken and seamlessly expanded to these circumstances in a way that's completely different from what we have here.
There was a vigorous debate in Washington over how much cash would go to individuals and how much to big business and who would oversee the spending. What about in other countries? How do politicians work out the details?
Most other countries are parliamentary systems. In the United Kingdom, for example, the Chancellor of the Exchequer comes up with a plan. He sends it to Parliament, and a moment later, they pass it, making essentially no modifications. So those types of systems can react much more quickly. They can also react in a more technocratic manner. If you look at the CARES Act in the United States, it reflects bargaining by Democrats in the House, the Democrats in the Senate, the Republicans in the House, the Republicans in the Senate. Lots of different powerful members of Congress got, you know, little tax breaks and other programs. So it's a bit of a messier hodgepodge what you see in the United States than the slightly more clean, streamlined responses you're seeing in a lot of other countries.
So I'm going to do something that I know you economists don't like, but look into the future, if you would. After the health crisis gets under control, which we all know is very difficult to predict, based on how governments are currently managing their economies, can you predict which countries will be back on their feet first?
I hate to do that. Unfortunately, we're going to learn an awful lot from studying the effectively different medicine that different countries are taking. It's almost like a randomized trial happening in real time. But I do think you're going to see places like Germany, Denmark, the Nordic countries that both have a set of social insurance programs in place, but also have an ability to have labor unions work together with employers to weather the storm better.
Jason Furman, an economist at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Jason, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here in the U.S., doctors with degrees from overseas medical schools play an important role. They often practice in the most underserved communities in this country, treating some of the most vulnerable Americans. But the COVID-19 pandemic is presenting challenges for doctors already here on work visas and for international physicians who have plans to be joining American hospitals pretty soon. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
1 in 4 doctors in the U.S. were born in another country. Many are on visas, often working in poor or rural areas that may soon be the front lines of the pandemic. Vara Panada is an Indian doctor on an H-1B visa in Waterloo, Iowa, where several people have tested positive for COVID-19.
So, yeah, we are at risk of getting the infection, like that happened to the doctors in Italy and China.
But unlike other doctors who might be citizens or residents, Panada says if she gets sick, it has implications for her visa status.
Once we are disabled, we can't work, then we can't live in the country.
And neither can their children. Panada's lived in the U.S. for 10 years, and her son and daughter have grown up here. She wonders what will happen to her family if she dies.
Very scary situation even to think of. Like, you know, some of us are getting nightmares about that. Like, what happens to our kids who are in school? Where is our future? We do not know.
Physicians like Panada are playing an increasingly vital role as U.S. hospitals face staffing shortages caused by the coronavirus. Even in the best of times, the U.S. depends on a steady supply of international medical graduates to staff its hospitals. 7,000 newly minted doctors are scheduled to begin hospital residencies on July 1st, a time when they will probably be desperately needed. The question is, can they get to the U.S.?
The highways are blocked. All the courier and mail services are non-functional.
Basim Ali is a medical school graduate in Pakistan. He's supposed to be joining a Texas hospital, but he can't get the paperwork he needs for his visa from the Pakistani Ministry of Health. He says things could still get better by July.
I'm hopeful that by that time, either the COVID crisis mitigates or we are in a better position where things are happening faster than they are right now.
Because it's not like he can just cancel with the U.S. hospital, Ali says. He's signed a contract. William Pinsky is CEO of the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates, the U.S. agency that certifies people with international degrees to work in U.S. hospitals. He says despite the COVID outbreak, the State Department is working to bring these international graduates who've been accepted at U.S. hospitals to the states.
If indeed, as the time gets closer, it appears that air travel is a significant barrier, then we'll start having conversations with people that can impact air travel and see if there's anything that can be arranged.
In the meantime, he says the U.S. could be considering other sources of help. For instance, there are thousands of people in the U.S. with international medical degrees who never got one of the coveted and competitive training assignments that would allow them to work in a hospital.
There very likely is a role for these people.
Pinsky says it's possible they could do tasks that would free up experienced doctors, like help with medical note-taking or manning phone banks to answer questions. His agency could verify their credentials, he says, and then it would be up to local regulatory authorities to determine how they could help.
Get me in already. We need it. We can't be nitpicky right now at this time. Like, desperate times call for desperate measures.
Rami Baya has a medical degree from a Caribbean college, and he's living in Dallas right now as the city faces a pandemic.
It's just frustrating for me and like the thousands of people who they they have the skills, they have the knowledge, they have the ability, just as anyone else in the medical field, but we're just sitting there idly doing nothing.
Baya is a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen. He says if he can't help people where he is, he may head to Canada. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
We've been reporting on the situation with COVID-19 in Russia, where the number of cases was at first downplayed, but now they are decidedly on the rise. Today, Russia confirmed more than 600 new cases, bringing the country's official total to more than 4,000. Compared to the U.S., that's not much, but we may not be getting the full picture.
Of course, I think that the quantity of patients with coronavirus is much higher than government says.
That's Dr. Anastasia Vasilieva. She's the head of Russia's Alliance of Doctors trade union. She was speaking with me last week on the show. Vasilieva's been reporting that many COVID-19 cases in Russia are likely being falsely classified as pneumonia cases, a level of transparency that apparently has bothered Russian officials. The World's Daniel Hoffman has been following the story closely. What was Dr. Vasilieva saying about the outbreak, Daniel?
So as we heard there, Marco, and as she told us last week on the show, she's been blowing the whistle about the fact that Russia is likely underreporting cases. She says that many of the cases have been likely classified as pneumonia cases, and she says that Russia is most likely not prepared for a widespread outbreak. So after speaking publicly about some of these issues, Russian authorities detained her.
What's going on there, Daniel?
This is taking place in the Novgorod region in Russia. Dr. Vasilieva and other volunteers were delivering masks and other protective equipment for medics at a local hospital. Now, police closed in on them and detained them on the spot. I spoke with Ivan Konovalov. He works with Dr. Vasilieva, and he was with her at the time of the arrest.
So they detained her. They did it really, really rough, used force. They were detaining her for 13 hours. The thing is, it is illegal.
So Konovalov there says this arrest is illegal. Where does Dr. Vasilieva's case stand now?
So Konovalov, the other volunteers, and Dr. Vasilieva were stopped because of, quote, non-compliance with the rules of conduct to prevent and liquidate an emergency situation. So basically that's legalese for not listening to government restrictions on travel during this pandemic. Now, the volunteers say that they had all the proper travel permits and that they were delivering much needed medical supplies. Now, all the volunteers were quickly released. Only Vasilieva remained in custody. Now, we just learned today that she too was released and charged with, quote, disobeying police orders. This whole ordeal was most likely a scare tactic from the Russian authorities.
And a scare tactic to do what?
A scare tactic to make sure that citizens, and especially leaders like the head of a doctor's union, don't go out of line.
Daniel, what does all this say about the Russian government's response to COVID-19?
The word that comes to mind for me is disjointed. I mean, as this pandemic has been hitting Russia, there's been a very mixed response from Russian authorities. First, Putin announced that they would have an extended weekend, and then local authorities decided to put some cities into quarantine. The Russian authorities have been going back and forth in terms of their response. And now we see kind of this wave of control, whether that's using technology in order to track and follow certain Russian citizens who have contracted COVID-19, or like in this case, actually arresting people who are speaking out about underreporting.
The World's Daniel Hoffman, thank you very much for this update.
Thank you very much, Marco.
You're listening to The World. Hello, public media fans. We know you value what we do here at The World, but it costs a lot of money to bring you these important stories. Important stories with context and critical voices from the front lines in our interconnected world. That's why we are asking for your support during our spring campaign. These days, more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking you to help support it now. Go to theworld.org/give. Become a monthly supporter of the program that informs, educates, and connects you with our changing world. That's theworld.org/give. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Covington, Louisiana, there's a sample of the new coronavirus tucked away in a secure freezer. Last week, it was used to infect monkeys. Monkeys will again be used in the future to test possible vaccines. Primates have helped scientists find treatments for polio, HIV, Ebola, and other diseases. Now researchers across the globe are looking to them again and anxiously awaiting the results from Louisiana. The World's Rachel Rock has our story.
To enter Tulane's regional biocontainment lab, you pass through an outer gate, a full-height metal turnstile, across a 100-foot walkway, and then you reach a heavy metal door. Next, you enter a negative pressure chamber, from which no air or dangerous particles can escape. It makes it hard to even open the door.
There are very few places in the world that have the capabilities that we have. There's really everything that you could imagine that you would need to address this epidemic is really here.
Jay Rappaport directs Tulane's National Primate Research Center. The U.S. built 14 biocontainment labs in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks as part of the nation's biodefense system.
We're the only one that has a regional biocontainment lab that was really set up for an event like this. We have the largest capacity for biosafety level 3, which is what coronavirus is.
When it comes to testing monkeys, step 1, infect them. This began here last Thursday. Step 2, if a monkey's immune system is mimicking a human, get some ready for testing.
So many people that have vaccines, there's not that many places to test it.
There's a reason to do the testing on monkeys, says Dr. Giovanni Piedemonte. He's Tulane's vice president for research and a professor at the Tulane School of Medicine.
The information you can get from the cells and from mice is never going to be comparable to the information you can get in monkeys because non-human primates are the closest thing that to humans, both immunologically, but also in terms of the transmission.
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you too.
Shelley Falkenstein drives me to see Tulane's colony of 5,000 monkeys.
I am the colony epidemiologist here, so my job is looking after the colony.
We reach the monkeys, and Falkenstein tosses treats into their outdoor enclosures. It's Falkenstein's job to help maintain a healthy and balanced monkey population here. That means only around 400 to 500 monkeys can be removed each year for research. She understands that some may see infecting animals as cruel, but Falkenstein says this is about serving the greater good.
You know, when I look at these monkeys, as much as I love these monkeys, if something that we're working on, vaccine-related or whatever, if it's going to provide a cure or a treatment for my child or somebody else's child or somebody else's parent, that is what helps me have peace about what I'm doing.
Tulane's Primate Research Center has always been a global institution with a particular expertise in infectious diseases. It established outposts in Africa during the AIDS crisis and again during the Ebola crisis. And investigators were instrumental during the SARS and Zika outbreaks in Asia and Latin America. With this outbreak, Giovanni Piedemonte has been in regular contact with colleagues and friends in Europe.
I have to tell you, they are incredibly concerned and puzzled. The evolution of the epidemic in Italy and now also in Spain has fundamental differences from what we are seeing in the United States.
The mortality rate in Italy and Spain has been much higher than in the U.S.
The other bizarre thing, and the other very difficult to understand, is why Germany, for example, has such a low mortality rate and also infectious rate.
Researchers are hoping monkeys can help solve these riddles. In mid-March, researchers in China successfully infected 4 monkeys with the new coronavirus and are studying how they respond. Scientists at Tulane are now trying to see if they can reproduce those findings. Skip Baum is the Associate Director and Chief Veterinary Medical Officer of the Tulane National Primate Research Center.
With respect to coronavirus, what we need to find out is, number one, can non-human primates be infected? And we think that that is the case. Once you can prove that they're infected, that's just the first step.
Scientists will then look at how a monkey's immune system responds and how the virus is shed. Put simply, what does the virus do on its way in, and which monkey fluids carry it out? This data could help immediately to blunt the virus's impact on humans. But Baum cautions, animal vaccine studies move much more quickly than human trials.
You can't cut corners because you don't want to put something that's unsafe into human beings. That would be a bigger tragedy than the epidemic.
Even though scientists around the globe have been working together with unprecedented collaboration and speed, Baum echoes what most scientists say. It will be a year, at the earliest, when a vaccine could be developed. And even that would be historically fast. For The World, Rachel Rock, Covington, Louisiana.
Someday there will be great art made about this moment. Coronavirus, the musical, too soon perhaps. But one family in Kent, England, is already considering the possibilities.
One day more, another day, another destiny, shopping for online delivery. Try to get a lead to find there's nothing till September time. One day more.
Those are the musical stylings of the Marsh family. If you're a fan of musicals or a Victor Hugo aficionado, you might recognize the tune. It's from Les Misérables, the show about the plight of the 19th century working poor in France. But the Marsh family reimagined it, a lockdown-inspired Les Mis with new lyrics. Here's dad, Ben Marsh.
The nice thing about changing the words is that they could all sing about stuff that they like. So yeah, football and school. Grandparents, which is a massive issue for everyone. Being able to communicate online.
Yep, Grandma and Grandpa's IT issues get a few lines in the song. And just in case you're hearing these kids harmonize and recite their lyrics perfectly and thinking, why can't my family do that? Well, the first few moments of their rehearsal should give you some hope.
Why are you hitting me? I haven't done anything.
What? Yeah, you're being nice.
She just hit me all day. That's all she's done to me all day.
No,
all
she
did was tell you. Shh, shh. She's a bully.
Sound familiar? I guess staging a musical is a good way to keep your kids distracted in the age of remote learning. And the added bonus, if the critics are kind, the results are a nice distraction for other people, too. The family's video has gotten millions of views on YouTube. Here's Ben Marsh again.
We've had these incredible messages from people coming off night shifts, ICU nurses, and it's just absolutely lovely for us to see that positivity and people saying, you know, this has brought a smile at a moment where it's difficult to smile. We didn't expect any of this to happen, but we're just really, really chuffed.
One day more, one day at a time. And there is so much time inside now these days, so think about all the things that you can put together as a Broadway musical. A 5, 6, 7, 8, and the curtain. News headlines are coming up in about 60 seconds. You're listening to The World. A dystopian horror movie. It's the unofficial film of the pandemic in Spain. And in Brazil, this is what it sounds like lately. Banging on pots and pans, not to celebrate healthcare workers, but to protest the government's response to the pandemic. That's still ahead here on The World. Iran has the fifth highest death toll from COVID-19. The ranks of the government itself have been hit hard. The country's parliamentary speaker is the latest official to test positive. Most schools and businesses in Iran have been closed for about a month, and many Iranians have been staying home for weeks. The world's Shirin Jafari checked in with some of them.
Omid Shukuhi has lost count of the number of days he's been at home. At first, the government said stay home for 2 weeks, he says. Then another 2 weeks. And another. It never ends. Shukuhi lives in Tehran. Think of it as the New York City of Iran. Densely populated, super expensive, but full of life. Before the pandemic, Shukuhi worked as a tour guide. He made a decent living. Enough, he says, to let him set aside some savings. Now his life is turned upside down. His business is dead. He's lost all clients. The worst part, he says, is not knowing when he can get back to work.
مثلا یک قلم جنسو بهت مثال بزنم موز بود کیلویی 12000 تومان
He says the price of bananas, for example, has doubled just in the past 2 weeks. That's a lot, he says. I'm lucky I have some savings. What about the daily wage workers? How can they survive? In a video circulating online, a street vendor asks the same question. He says he works near a busy metro station in Tehran. But the police come here every day and they tell me I must go home, he says. How can I feed my family if I go home? I'm poor. This week, Iran's government announced a $5 billion financial relief package for low-income families impacted by the coronavirus. But President Hassan Rouhani made it clear that the country is likely going to be dealing with this pandemic for months to come. Iran's economy was already hit hard before the outbreak, partly because of heavy economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. And while some people are wondering whether they can survive financially, others are struggling to overcome the disease. Behzad Meghouni is one of thousands of Iranians who've contracted COVID-19. I reached the 41-year-old at his home just outside of Tehran. He tells me he's recovering. Slowly. I'm just thankful I survived, he says, that I can breathe again. Behzad works for the Tehran municipality. He thinks he got infected in February when Iran was holding parliamentary elections. He was an observer at one of the polling stations. Shortly after, he started showing symptoms, loss of smell, fever, shortness of breath. He says the doctors told him to rest at home. There was no room for him at the hospital. He spent 20 days in isolation, sick, in bed. The nights were the worst, he says. He would have coughing fits so bad, he wondered if he'd make it to the morning. I always thought I would be the last person to get sick, Behzad tells me. I work out every day, I hike on the weekends, I eat healthy. But this disease, it's no joke. At this point, the coronavirus pandemic has touched almost every country in the world. But until last month, Iran and Italy had some of the highest numbers of cases outside of China, which for Maziar Ghiabi seemed like a bizarre turn of events.
I'm an Italian-Iranian, so my family is based both in Iran, while my parents live in Lombardy, so actually at the very epicenter of the COVID-19 epidemic.
Ghiabi's parents are in Italy. His grandparents and cousins are in Iran. He lives in the UK. They've been trading stories about life under quarantine. This is an audio message his cousin sent him recently. I just disinfected a tub of ice cream before I put it in the freezer, he says. Can you believe that? Ghiabi, it turns out, studies public health and politics. So this pandemic is also providing him with plenty of research material.
You know, in a way, I was living, you know, in two areas exposed to the epidemic, which had government responses on the initial stages of the contagion, which were very slow, reluctant, of course, to take any measures, and also quite in denial.
He's already coordinating research projects with his colleagues in Iran. It's the first time, he says, he is studying his own lived experience. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Meanwhile, this is what evenings in Brazilian cities like Rio de Janeiro sound like. All over the world, we've been hearing the percussion of pots and pans as a way to celebrate health workers on the front lines of COVID-19. But these Brazilians are not celebrating, they're protesting. The world's Maria Helena Romero here in Boston has been following the news out of Brazil. Why are Brazilians protesting, Maria Helena?
These protests have been taking place in cities across the country, reacting to the president's comments that minimize the potential impact of the pandemic in Brazil. He has called for mayors and governors to relax social isolation measures imposed to control the spread of the virus. At one point, Bolsonaro said governors were reacting with hysteria. While the coronavirus has affected Brazilians of all social classes, there is a special concern for those who live in the slums, or favelas, as they are known. In these communities, people live in very confined environments with poor ventilation. So this means that in many homes, people do not have water to wash their hands, which is something that is key to prevent the spread of the virus.
So I know you've been speaking with people inside the favelas. What have you been hearing?
Right. To help me understand all this situation, I spoke with Leandro Lima. He's in Rocinha, one of the largest slums in Rio de Janeiro.
Estou em confinamento em casa desde então.
Leandro is high risk for coronavirus. He has asthma and bronchitis since he was a child. So since early March, he has been quarantining his home in Rio. For him, the coronavirus is a matter of life or death.
And so somebody like Leandro, who's at high risk, I mean, where is he getting his information on the coronavirus from?
I mean, thankfully, Leandro is a person that knows where to look for proper information.
E o próprio governo tá no embate político de uma forma que ele é muito irresponsável.
Leandro tells me that he has heard all these bizarre and confusing messages coming from the president, and is very much concerning him.
The slums, the favelas, are often controlled by gangs, the drug traffickers. I mean, that sounds terrible, but it's partly because many police just stay away. Does that mean that the gangs are now involved in protecting the favelas from the coronavirus?
They have, Marco. In the Rio slums, gangs have established a night curfew during these times. They have sent messages via WhatsApp and post signs around the neighborhood, just asking people to stay at home and take the situation seriously. Basically, slums have been neglected by governments. They have little or no police presence. So gangs act sort of as a parallel authority. They are dangerous. They are armed. But in this case, they are apparently attempting to prevent further infections.
So it seems like President Jair Bolsonaro is not only fighting the coronavirus, but now he's fighting a political battle at home. How does this crisis reflect on Bolsonaro's administration?
Not great. Bolsonaro is isolated politically. People have been frustrated with the administration's response, and they protest every night. And even some of Bolsonaro's messages on social media platforms have been taken down just because they are considered misinformation.
The World's Maria Elena Romero, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Marco.
After the coronavirus hit China, South Korea, as you'll recall, became the next big center of the outbreak. The response in South Korea was prompt. The government acted fast and successfully flattened the curve of transmission. South Korea's healthcare system has come under strain, but it has not been overwhelmed like in some other countries. So now what? As daily life starts to return to normal in South Korea, authorities are working to prevent a secondary wave of infections. Jason Strother reports from Seoul.
The arrivals terminal at Incheon International Airport is nowhere near as busy as usual, but the airlines are still flying. People are coming in and out of the country. Passengers landing here who present COVID-19 symptoms, or those who've come from Europe, they all get tested. Then they're sent to a hospital, if need be. People are still allowed to come greet their friends or relatives here at the arrivals terminal.
Gentlemen in hazmat suits are directing the arriving passengers to a waiting area before they can board a bus or train back to their hometowns.
Some travelers are pulling suitcases. Everyone is wearing a mask. Authorities say the majority of recent inbound passengers are South Korean citizens. They're coming home from abroad, including from countries where the number of infections is rising out of control. Kim Gang-lip is a senior health official. He says some of these returnees are bringing the coronavirus back with them. Here's Kim speaking at a televised COVID-19 briefing through an interpreter.
We are continuing to witness increase of the patients here in Korea, and we believe that we cannot let our guards down as of yet.
What that means is that every new arrival to South Korea must self-quarantine for 14 days. If they don't have a place to stay, they're directly sent to a government facility and billed later. Kim says this is for the sake of everyone's health and safety.
we will abide by the principle of non-tolerance for those who fail to comply with self-quarantine measures.
That means an $8,000 fine, a year in jail, or deportation. People entering South Korea are also required to download a health check app. It's linked to the Centers for Disease Control here. Kelly Chang has one on her phone. The 40-year-old teacher flew in from San Francisco just ahead of the new quarantine order. But since Chang still practices social distancing, she explained to me how the app works on FaceTime.
The app is called 자가진단. It's kind of got the Korean, the yin-yang sign of the Korean flag. And every day I have to go and I have to hit the go to self-diagnosis blue tab. And it asks me four questions. Do you have a fever, cough, sore throat, or difficulty breathing? And I have to click yes or no, and I have to click submit.
And you have been diligently submitting your status every day since you've come back?
Of course.
If users get sick, the app tells them where to seek medical care. Dr. Jerome Kim is Director General of the International Vaccine Institute in Seoul. He knows about the smartphone app, partly because his daughter had to use it. Kim says it's a useful tool that should help South Korea to keep flattening the curve, at least in theory.
The system is designed to be implemented by people of good faith. Are all people of good faith? And will all of them follow the self-quarantine? Not necessarily, but the app does also track you.
But tracking the movements of non-compliant people doesn't go far enough for some medical professionals. The Korean Medical Association has called for tighter border controls since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. In its YouTube newscast this week, the anchorwoman called the self-quarantine regulations naive. She mentions news reports about a British national who was caught outside without a mask before testing positive for the coronavirus. He was supposed to be in quarantine. But Jerome Kim from the Vaccine Institute says closing the border wouldn't accomplish much in the long term.
It's easy to be self-congratulatory at this point, but it's really just the first wave, and you're going to have to wait for the next one.
Kim says models show that a second COVID-19 wave could hit South Korea later this year. To prevent that, he says countries across the globe need to find a better way to cooperate.
You'll need to have in place some mechanism for ensuring that infected people don't hop on a plane and inadvertently set off a new outbreak. So we have to figure that out, and I don't think we've done that yet.
For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
Another day, another postponement. The annual UN Climate Summit that had been scheduled for this fall, that's been pushed back to 2021. The gathering was planned for this November in Scotland. It was seen as a key meeting in getting countries on track to meet the carbon cuts laid out in the Paris Agreement. Nicholas Huna with the nonprofit New Climate Institute says these summits require focused attention from leaders.
All of these diplomatic activities are now not possible in the current crisis. People have other things to do. And that's why it's, I think, a very good idea to postpone the conference.
One silver lining, says Huna, the delay will push the summit until after the U.S. presidential inauguration.
But at least the uncertainty is gone. The world knows exactly who they deal with in the next 4 years in the U.S., and that will make it easier to operate.
Huna says he hopes leaders can strike a balance between two crises and maybe even find solutions that address both of them.
Yeah, hopeful that we can use all the pain that we have to go through because of corona and try to really make actions that also have a benefit for the climate.
Nicholas Huna with the nonprofit New Climate Institute. There have been a couple of Hollywood productions about pandemics. Now there's an unofficial film for this particular one. It was shot in Spain and it's called El Hoyo.
Hay tres clases de personas. Los de arriba.
It's a dystopian thriller. In English, it's called The Platform, and it has skyrocketed to number one in many countries. The World's Jorge Valencia spoke with the film's director to find out more.
I have to admit it. At first, I wasn't interested in this film. I mean, we're living through a pandemic. Why do I need to watch a movie about isolation and scarcity? But my brother recommended it, so I turned it on, and from minute number one, I couldn't look away. Even the morning after, I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Soy Galder Gastelu Urrutia y soy director de cine.
Galder Gastelu Urrutia is the director.
Nada, cuéntame. Espero tus preguntas.
I reach him over the phone at his house in northern Spain.
Bueno, pues estoy en mi casa, en Bilbao.
In Basque country, in the city of Bilbao. And like many people these days, in the middle of a weekday afternoon, he is still in his pajamas.
Estoy en pijama ahora mismo.
For Gaztelu Urrutia, the news that The Platform is one of the most popular films and one of the most popular video streaming services is bittersweet.
Porque sé que parte del éxito es debido a este momento tan triste que está viviendo el mundo.
He says he knows that part of his success is because of this very sad moment the world is going through. He directed the film in Basque country, largely with local funding and local talent, no one famous. It was his first feature-length film. And when it was released in theaters across Spain last November, it wasn't that big.
Pues es una película que tuvo sus fans, su acogida, pero desde luego no fue una...
The film had some fans, Gaztelu Urrutia explains, and it made some money. International recognition, though, was just around the corner, thanks to Netflix. Company executives had paid for the right to distribute the film a few months earlier at the Toronto Film Festival. And by then, they had already decided to release The Platform for streaming in early spring this year. The film begins in the civilized world. And then it gets dark. The setting is a vertical prison. On each level, there is one cell with two prisoners. And this alarm tells the prisoners when a platform from the level above is about to bring down their next meal. The story is full of symbols that I won't get into here, but beyond isolation and scarcity, there's also race. One of the characters is a man of African background who asks for help to climb from his floor to the next. Director Gaztelu Urrutia tells me that character represents the many migrants who have risked their lives to get to Europe. The man's attempt is not successful. That's not a big spoiler, by the way. But Gaztelu Urrutia wanted to get across the idea that
siempre hay un que no te dejará pasar.
There's always going to be an expletive who's not going to let you through, he says. The cast comes from many backgrounds. One actor is of Filipino descent. Characters speak in French and in Russian.
Y en italiano y en árabe también hay.
And in Italian and in Arabic, Gaztelu Urrutia says. He explains he wants the story to be universal.
La humanidad lleva hablando de esto desde que es humanidad.
Humanity has been talking about scarcity and isolation for as long as humans have existed, Gaztelu Urrutia says. He says Dante's Divine Comedy was an inspiration for the film. For me, The Platform reminded me more of dystopian films from the last two decades, like I Am Legend with Will Smith or Children of Men with Clive Owen.
Yo soy leyenda, la he visto cuatro veces. Y Hijos de los Hombres... No sé,
Gaztelu Urrutia says he's a fan. He's seen Children of Men five times and I Am Legend four. But The Platform is not very Hollywood in one key aspect.
Un final implicaría una respuesta.
Hollywood endings usually give a crystal clear answer, Gaztelu Urrutia says. And he's more interested in asking questions than in answering them. Either way, The Platform is having success across languages and borders. In the 2 weeks since the film was released on Netflix, Gaztelu Urrutia has been getting mail from fans in Israel and in the United Arab Emirates,
Canada y en México y en Alemania y en Francia,
and in Canada and Mexico and Germany and France, he says. Meanwhile, he's still at home in his pajamas, pretty much doing the same thing he would have been doing without COVID-19, writing more movie scripts.
Si esto era el éxito, vaya, a mí me engañaron.
If this is what success looks like, then I've been deceived, he says. Although, as he himself points out, we're living in a time when just being at home, alive and well, is a privilege and a success. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
As if all the coronavirus news wasn't disheartening enough, one of the great songwriters left us this week, Bill Withers, of a heart attack at 81. Withers' classic Lean On Me has had a revival lately. It's become an anthem sung out of windows and front doors and rooftops by those wanting to cheer on the medical workers who are working long days and nights to help in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. Bonnie Curry in Dallas, Texas was inspired to sing after seeing Italians sing in support of their health workers. So Bonnie opened her window this past week.
You're not strong.
In the UK, people have been singing it to honor the National Health Service workers. Karen O'Connor went so far as to get a microphone and sing loud and proud in the town of Stevenage.
I'll share your load. If you just call me a friend.
It's a song that resonates for so many of us, especially now. So we're thinking of everyone on the front lines of the pandemic. We lean on you guys so much. And thinking, too, of Bill Withers. Thank you for a lifetime of great music. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. Thank you, too, for being with us today. We'll see you back here Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.